And thank everybody again who's helped us open the meeting by reading, and take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Warm welcome to any visitors to our meeting tonight, and a particular welcome to any newcomers that might be with us. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we are a speaker meeting, as I said, and I'm really pleased to be able to introduce our speaker this evening is a home group member. It's really nice to have a home group member sharing with us tonight. And this particular individual rocked into our meetings, I don't know, it must be 18 months or so ago now, and has become a really valuable member of the Highlands and Islands. Does service at this meeting. Yeah, a really valued member. I enjoy what she shares, and we have a lot of things that we identify with all kinds of different ways. She's just celebrated a particular milestone in recovery. I shall let her speak to that should she choose to. They're going to share with us for 40 or 45 minutes on their experience, strength, and hope, or whatever length of time is comfortable to them. So, without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Penny. So, Penny, please share with us. The floor is yours.
Oh, thank you, Steve. My name's Penelope Penny, whatever you like to call me. I answer to both, but my name is Penelope, and I'm an addict.
Hello,
Hi,
Hi,
Penelope.
Penelope.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, hello.
Hey. Well, I mean, I'm doing a chair-a-thon at the moment, seems like. I know that several people have heard me before, but yeah, I mean, I only have my own experience to share, and hope that people can identify with similarities, and because when it's wonderful to have a message to carry. I'm an addict that's I enjoyed taking drugs. If they still worked, I'd still be doing it, I'm sure. But the thing is that they got me into the worst trouble in my life. My using ended up being about using and having fun. Then it was using and having fun with consequences. And then in the end, it was just consequences. And the consequences were severe and dire. They cost me my self-esteem, my faith in anything other than the drugs. And, they cost me the love of my children, my family, my father, my mother, my career, my marriages. And since I've been clean, those things have actually healed. A lot of healing has happened by working the steps. The spiritual principles are so important to me and to anyone who wants to recover, to discover what they mean to you. I started using when I was quite young. I didn't realize when I first got clean, I thought it was only the street drugs, the powders, some of the pills. It was them that I thought made me an addict. I didn't realize that it was alcohol as well. I had a problem with natural things like growing my own grass plants and thinking that actually that was a good cure for opiate addiction. And it was like, are you sure I can't have a bottle of Valpolicella with my spaghetti, and I can't have a joint at the weekend? I can't, what are you people like? And it took me a while to get my head around all that stuff, because the more I spoke to people and learned how to ask for help, because in the beginning it's really hard to pick up the phone that weighs a ton and say to someone, help, I don't understand this, or can you tell me what I should do about this? And And I found out people don't tell you or give you advice. They suggest. And it's up to you whether you take up the suggestion. I mean, my using, I used drugs in the 60s, 70s, 80s. I got clean at the end of the 80s, and my clean date is the 1st of April 1989, and I've just celebrated 32 years clean because I have had continuous recovery all that time. I've always had a sponsor. I've always worked NA steps, and I was pretty crazy for the first 3 years of my recovery. So nobody ever asked me to sponsor them. Not that there were very many women about, but I thought, what's the matter with me? Well, I don't didn't realise. But I know that what happened was that I needed to be restored to sanity enough to be able to help another addict, and part of the learning of being restored to sanity was actually accepting help, which I think for addicts it's really hard to let people love them. We become so shut down. I know I was very shut down for a lot of years, and I didn't know it. And the odd thing is that emotions were my stock in trade, you know. And at the end, I was trying to manipulate the drugs to manipulate a feeling that I could use to earn a living. And I know that sounds complicated, but it was the way that it was. But then the drugs stopped working and doing what I thought they were going to do. It's like I'd fall asleep on speed or, you know, or coke, or I'd wake up. You know, I'd be wired taking downers, or, you know, I'd fall over somewhere, or, you know, being drunk as well, humiliating my children, being drunk in swimming pools when their friends were there, you know, the sort of things that I have made amends for. You know, my children are grown up now. But for a lot of years, there was an awful lot of resentment and pain and anger. And, you know, I wasn't well enough to sort them out. You know, I used to kind of think, well, you know, I can't go back to that 8-year-old and make it any different. But I can live differently today. That kept me going for a while, you know. Until I did the formal amends. I mean, in the beginning, it was like, you know, you have to put down all these drugs, and that's what they told me. And I just kept going to meetings and listening to other people's experience. I never went to treatment because I had children. I didn't have any money. I didn't have, there wasn't that much awareness about treatment. 30 years ago, it was like it was something one would dream about, somebody taking you in and detoxing you and giving you therapy for all the things that you've ever, you know, been insane about. And I actually found that by, you know, I white knuckled 3 methadone programs. I mean, it was a nightmare trying to get off the benzos. I knew I wanted to. In the end, I wanted to, but I didn't know that picking up another drug would actually get me back on the same drugs that I was trying to get off. And every time I'd end up on zero, because that would be, you know, I would have had, problems up and down, you know, kind of can't sleep. I'm up all night, up 20 nights, you know, more or less with just closing your eyes for a moment, you know, that sort of using. And it became habitual. And one of the things I learned when I got clean, eventually, was not to pick up the first one and to change the thinking. The thinking is where addiction lives, you know. I had an old sponsor that used to say to me, my disease lives between my ears, you know. And I used to be asleep and I'd wake up and it was like at the end of the bed going, oh, glad you're awake. I'm glad your eyes are open, you know. Do you know that you're not going to make it today? You have got, you know, this wrong with you, and you're too old, and what do you think you're doing, you know? And I believed all this chat. This is the loud voice of the disease of addiction. And what I had to find out was what that voice sounded like, you know, and be more detached from it, and go, oh yeah, it's chatting to me again, right? And write it down in my step one, which was, you know, my first step one. I mean, the end of my using, I lived in a caravan, and people have heard this story hundreds of times, but, you know, we didn't have any money. I didn't have a phone. We didn't have mobiles then. The car had gone, the phone had gone, the money had gone, the, you know, everything had gone. And I found an eyebrow pencil and old letters, and I wrote my first step one in the, this is why I know it works, right? What they suggest, you know, just to write it down. And what I saw when I read it back, I went to the phone box and phoned my sponsor. And I went, oh my God, do you know that it was this and that? And she said, yes, it's all right, calm down. Put it with your step four and we'll read it all together. Because in those days, we didn't have the working guide, right? You did the first three steps and then you did step four. But anyway, you know, what I saw in this step one was different place, different relationships, different places, different drugs, same pain. And that was just like, wow, you know. It woke me up, and I had this feeling that we get when we own something, you know, when we're actually honest with our innermost self. It's like, oh, okay, because I sort of knew it, but I used to shut that voice up, you know, with more drugs, you know, that voice that told me, you are one, you're an addict, you know. And and I used to say, shut up, I don't want to hear it. You know, it's got to take another drug, you know, forget about it for now. And but I'd got to the point where I did listen in meetings, and I went to meetings and people told me to share about what was going on. And I was in a lot of debt. I had, we hadn't paid any rent in this caravan. We hadn't paid any, you know, ground rent. We hadn't paid any electric, or, you know, and I was up to my ears in debt. I thought I was never, ever going to be able to sort it out, because I didn't realize about the miracles that happen when you get clean. I was just open to it, because you know, my arguments in my reservations in step one were about yes, but, you know, and I know, I've been here before, and, you know, I've been on this planet a long time, and I've been married twice, and I've been around the world and all that stuff. And it was like, yeah, I didn't know anything about anything, really. I had to have a complete blank canvas about what I knew, and be teachable. And it served me well to give up those reservations, because it does say in the basic text that our reservations rob us of the benefits of recovery. And so anywhere I look and I go, oh, no, I'm not doing that, you know, and I, oh, what do you think you're telling me? Who do you, how do you know what's right for me? You know, I mean, my first sponsor was 24 and I was like nearly 40. I think, no, I was more than 40. I was 41. And I was like, well, what do you know about recovery? You know, what do you know about my life? And she was like, well, she used to laugh at me all the time because I was so nuts. I was so nuts. And but actually, what she knew how to work the steps. And she showed me how to work the steps, and she was kind, and she wasn't like, I've heard people talk about, when they go to treatment centers and they've got some treatment center torturer going, you have to own this, you have to own up to this. And I mean, I'm a kind of addict, I won't do anything until I'm willing to do it, and I became willing. I was taught, well, if you're not willing, pray for willingness. And it's like prayer was something that I thought you had to go to the temple or the church or the cathedral or the Rasta church or the witch's circle or Buddhist thing. I didn't really think you could pray in your house, that you could actually make a connection to a higher power, whatever. I mean, for me, I'd looked in religion, all sorts of religion, and I could not. It was also battling and confusing, and it was like sometimes I think I thought of it as an external thing. And what I've realized over the years is it's within, it's within my. It's within my being, my consciousness, and it's not out there floating on a cloud. I mean, I've looked at angels and all the stuff that is connected with spirit. And I found that prayer worked. I mean, this guy came, he had a gold Rolex and a gold Mercedes, and he was like an Essex boy, and he was rich, and he was like, I'm gonna take this off, and I'm gonna tow you, off the land. You're not staying here. And I was terrified, and I was terrified of the cows in the field that I used to take the dog for a walk in. And another addict in the meeting said, bullocks. Went, what? He said, bullocks, they're bullocks, they've got little horns, and that's why they're chasing the dog and freaking you out. And I shared about the guy with the gold watch, the gold Rolex, and he was like, I never saw him again. I don't know what happened. I prayed about it, I prayed for God to remove the obsession. Obsession is the mind. It's in the mind. It's like, you grab a thought. A thought comes in. It's not unusual for us as addicts to think about using, even when we've been clean a long time. It can sometimes think, you go, oh, wonder if I could, what. But for me, I always remember my last use up. So that's what comes in. I get the taste in my mouth and the gut, and I know that I don't want to pick up because I know that I'd end up back there with the same set of problems that I've got. So I asked for that obsession to be removed because once I pick up drugs, I can't stop. And that's what happened. I went round and round and round in circles to try and get clean before I got to NA. And one drug led to another, to led to another, and one is too many, a thousand never enough really hit home with me. I can't have one of anything, today, I mean, today I use the kind of understanding of the spiritual principles of step one, which is like honesty and surrender. And that was something I was like, well, what is surrender? I'll give up, the current, and we'll give up. But no, I tried to give up before. It was something that happened, like I've just described. It's that knowing that you can't use anymore, and that when we're powerless, it means that we don't have any power against the disease. And it's not about the drugs so much as the disease that is like chatting away all the time, going, because its job is to kill us. And this, I take it very seriously because I know I've seen people die who've listened to it and have gone back out. You know, it is a killer illness, and you know, and it's insidious. It just doesn't go away. And what I do is I say, "Oh, thank you for sharing." I'm quite nice to the disease. I said, "Thank you for sharing." And I'm going to turn the volume down on you right now, and I'm going to turn it up on my higher power. And that's when I pray. And I mean, you know, these days it's an internal thing. I've internalized, I've worked the steps, and I know that they work. And yeah, I've done quite a lot of prayer through, you know, painful periods. And you know, recovery doesn't mean that we're never going to have anything happen ever again. Our lives can be quite painful sometimes. You know, trying to clean up the mess of the past, for example, is, you know, the mess within me. You know, my insanity. I couldn't walk out the door. I had to plan 20 minutes to faff around before I could walk out the door. I mean, I was agoraphobic, sociophobic. I couldn't go out. I was depressed. You know, I learned how to deal with all of these things without using. And my first step forward was about uncovering all this stuff, which was like, you know, I didn't know what I was writing about. I just used to write a prayer at the top of the page of every single page and ask God to help me to be thorough and honest and fearless. You know, ask for the courage to actually look at myself and what I'd done, and finding out the exact nature of my wrongs. You know, and how, you know, using the tools, the what I thought were the tools, but they were actually the weapons of the disease to keep people out, to you know, you know, I used lots of different tricks to keep people away from the painful bits of me, because I'd had like experiences with media and you know, where I'd be very vulnerable to their questions if I allowed it, you know. And so I had like mechanisms to shut down anything. But to be able to look myself and to actually share that process with another recovering addict who'd done that process themselves and who understood my pain or my addiction, or just prepared to listen and show me, you know, how to understand that. But you know, the spiritual nature of, you know, at step five, admit to myself, another human being, and God. You know, the spiritual nature of that is that, I mean, I used to think, well, God knows all this. He's helping me write it. You know what? But it is that kind of something happens on four and five. If you do those steps, big change takes place. Another lot of spiritual awakening happens, and just did. I put down, I had been carrying this bag around with me because I lived in the caravan with two kids that were like always searching through my stuff and looking at what I'd written, you know. So I was terrified they were going to find out what I'd written. A lot of it was came through that was about, you know, sex and stuff that I didn't want them to be reading. So I'd been carrying this heavy bag of writing around. I mean, I used to come to London on the train and go to three meetings, you know, and hang out in coffee shops and watch other people. I'd been watching other people carrying around these heavy files as well, looking a bit worried. And anyway, it was all in a terrible mess. There were bits of paper everywhere, and somebody I trusted in the fellowship took me to the beach, and sat on the beach, and I mean, I was more interested in all the beautiful shells, and I had a couple of pieces of rose quartz, and I was like, really, like the ozone was knocking me out, really, you know. And I didn't want to look at the numbers on the pages, you know, but I did finally sort it out, and I shared it with my sponsor, and I just felt like afterwards I had been booked to do a chair somewhere, you know, a detox, I couldn't believe what had happened. It was like I felt the presence of a higher power, and it was like, what is that, you know? And afterwards I felt like I was levitating in my trainers, because I was, you know, I was so buoyant. I'd put down this heavy weight. And, you know, life felt wonderful. I mean, you have to know that the first 3 years of my recovery, everybody was like recovering in those days and going out and get a job, and they all got this wonderful career. And I'm at home, I'm a single mom, and I'm just like, got two mad kids, you know. I mean, I'd spend all day trying to get the money together to get a food on the plate, you know, to go and get the shopping, to get to cook the food, put it on the plate, put it on the table, and one of them would look at the other one, and the table would be tipped up. Suddenly there's a skateboard sticking out of the wall. It was like a nightmare. That, you know, and I just, you know, I was always holding my head. You know, I'd be in the kitchen cooking, and the dog would come down the stairs, like holding her paws over her ears, you know, like, oh, and her eyes, you know. And I knew it was kicking off upstairs, because, you know, that's what they did. They picked rows with each other, and then they ganged up on me. And during all this time, I was like, I was in a lot of self-pity, because by that time, what had happened was my caravan had burnt down. I was like, oh, you couldn't write this stuff. I mean, I don't know what happened. I mean, I'm sitting in the caravan one night, I had this pinging going off. It was a TV set. It just like burst into flames. And, you know, I looked in the room, and it was like covered in flames, and, you know, I shut the door really quickly, because one thing I'd remembered was when you got fire, you shut the door, you know. And, well, you know, I mean, it burnt down in 4 minutes. The fire brigade took 10 minutes to get them, you know. Part of that miracle that happened was I had listened to people in the fellowship making suggestions to get my kids out of that cardboard box. And put my name down on a housing list. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. But there's so many people had suggested it. And I thought, ah, all right. And people pleasing, I went and I did put my name down. And, you know, the weird thing is that on the night of the fire, the housing people that, you know, that were supposed to come out, he was on holiday and his locum was sick. And the head of housing came out, and he felt sorry for us. We were standing there with black faces, you know, squelching around in all this material possessions that were all soaking wet and burnt. And he gave us a 3-bedroom house, and I'm just like, what happened? I don't know. And, you know, anyway, so I'd been living in, because I was really, really scared. I didn't know that I was going to get this house, and I was frightened, and the kids were screaming, and anyway, but there was no furniture. And then suddenly we got a guy at the meeting that I used to go to on a Monday, and he got all the women to empty their wardrobes and brought all these black plastic sacks of amazing clothes, and all these amazing 80s clothes that were absolutely out of fashion, you know, but I thought they were wonderful. And it was something to wear because I had nothing. And you know, but I mean, I did. I went into self-pity. I went into deep, like, you know, deep down defects, and didn't want to get up. Did a lot of duvet therapy, and my sponsor, you know, when I did go out and go to the phone box, you know, in this new house I'd got, you know, but I'd be like, ooh. She said to me, "What about that meeting you were going to start? You know, you said you were talking about starting a meeting." So anyway, I was like, "Oh no, I can't." It was, you know, it was snowing, and you know, I didn't want to go out in the snow and look for a venue. But I did. I don't know what happened. I just had enough one day and was like, got up and made, you know, went to the phone box and made inquiries about how, you know, what sort of venues were available. And I found a venue and went to the ASC, and they gave me a starter pack. And well, the upshot was I got support from people that I knew that wanted to come down to, you know, Essex to share. But most weeks I sat on my own with a basic text, and I always kept the meeting open for an hour and a half. I don't know that many people would have done that, but I had faith that it would work. I have to say, it took 2 years for the meeting to have, you know, a tea person and then a literature person, and then, you know, it was tough in those days. You know, there weren't many meetings in London. You know, the idea that it was a global fellowship in those days was like, yeah, you what? Oh, they've got meetings in America. Yeah, somebody give you a tape of, you know, somebody in America. We, you know, I just sat there, and I always read the basic text while I was there, because I did feel that higher power was with me, the one that saw me through my step five. And yeah, I mean, through my willingness, somehow things got better. I was more willing to let go of the defects that were so agonizing, but also the little ones, you know, the ones where the big defects bring their little friends, and you just go, oh, you know, I'm scared, you know, self-pity, you know, I mean, the way they all fit together, I mean, it's just, you know, and they don't go away. Obviously, I haven't had them surgically removed, but it's like having Pickfords. You know, God puts them somewhere where they're useful, parks them up for a while, and you don't notice you're not doing it anymore. But you know, they haven't been removed forever. And then making a list, I made a list with my, you know, with my sponsor, and you know, did step eight. And then I lost the list. I think one of my children might have nicked it or done something with it, or, you know, I couldn't find it. So I didn't have to make another one. And, you know, some of the things that were on it were kind of things that, you know, like my agent, for example, and you know, my children, my ex-husbands, and my mother who died in my using, and my dad, who was he was still alive, but he was quite old. You know, people that were important to me. You know, financial amends, they were hard. I had to learn to negotiate with people about things that I couldn't you know, afford, so I had to pay them off in installments. You know, kind of during this period of time, I was back at yoga, doing a yoga class, and somebody kind of said they were all going off to learn meditation, and they told me about the person that was teaching them. it was too late for me to get on that session. So I got onto this person, and he taught me a method of meditation which has served me very well all the way through. You know, it's like my first meditation in my caravan was like calm, you know, because I had screaming going on in my head and screaming going on in my gut, and I go, you know, and I was on my own because kids were at school and there were no meetings. You couldn't phone anybody unless you wanted to go up to the phone box. I couldn't get out the door. I mean, God knows how I'm clean, yeah. But the fact is, I just sat there and read the basic text and, you know, and said calm. That was my first, you know, and I learned to breathe as well. That helped with the anxiety, you know, breathe into four, hold for four, breathe out to four, hold for four, breathe into four, and just keep doing that until you feel calmer. But this meditation was, you know, more formal meditation, and it was like you do it twice a day, and I was like, what? I haven't got time to do that twice, you know. But yeah, well, I did it twice a day, and I have done for 30 years. And yeah, I'm doing sort of making the amends process. Was like, for example, my agent was, I wanted to make amends to her because I caused her harm. And my sponsor was going, oh, are you sure? You know, this isn't self-will. And I just knew that it was, I was being moved to do it. And I went to meet her, and you know, it was wonderful to see her. And she was like, she gave me some quite firm, stern advice, and obviously, you know, she was a very early feminist Australian, strangely enough, and I just like, strange thing happened that she sent me loads of things, and I was in this office being interviewed for a job, and they went, oh, who's your agent? And I said, blah, blah. And didn't you know she died? And so I had made the amends to her before she died, and it was like I'd been moved to do that. I still think of her sometimes. There are certain streets in London near where she lived that I've had, you know, occasion to go down, and I think of her often. And bless her, she was, you know, she was great. She was good for me. My sponsor was Australian as well, so I have a big affinity with the Australian fellowship these days. I really like them, their recoveries, and it's accessible, isn't it? Wonderful, you know. I got a mobile phone. when I was like about 13 years clean, I suddenly hit all this stuff around relationships, and it was huge. And I think I was a real teenager. I lived the teenage years that I didn't live, you know. Oh my goodness, you know, romances and finances, and back to step six. I did the steps again. I did the steps again and again, you know, all the way through. In the meantime, in Essex, the first lot of amends, I did what was done for me when I lived in the caravan. I went to places and picked people up. I ended up getting a car. I was a contact and did 12-step, work on, you know, I was on the helpline, and people knew me in the meetings. Got asked to sponsor people, I became saner. I'm not cured, you know, but we do recover. Which is something that I love about NA because I watch people get well, and it's a wonderful thing. During the course of amending my relationship with my daughter, it was really difficult. It was really hard. She went traveling. She went to Costa Rica. She went backpacking on her own round. Well, I was like, "What? Don't you realize how dangerous it is? Mum, I want to see a rainforest before they're gone. I want to see a rainforest before I die. Anyway, that was her. My son was different. It sort of took a while to. He quietly, his addiction was quietly working in his life, and he completely messed up, and I had to live with the results of that. He didn't come out of his room for months, and he was really depressed, and I found out that it was because the using had gone. It wasn't just a drink. It was it was a lot of other things, and long story short, he's been clean 18 and three quarter years, which for me that's just, oh, I mean, his recovery, I love him. I love him to death. He's so, he's been over today helping me with some light fittings and things because I'm a bit wobbly up the ladders these days. And he, and we hang out together, and he's really beautiful. His recovery is great. He has a good sponsor, and I was doing service with his sponsor once, and I was going blah, 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 about something, and he went, "Well," he said, "you don't realize I've heard your son's first step five," and I was like, "Oh my God, I don't know what it, but it obviously worked." So, like the program does, and I've been involved with service for a long time. I realize I'm probably going on a bit, but I've done a lot of service in NA. I've always been really grateful. I was told when you're asked to do service, say yes. That's why I'm doing the charathon at the moment. I mean, I've been area service, I've done group service, I've done everything that there is on, a group and area service, GSR, and regional service as well. And I've chaired conventions and chaired the London Convention twice, and that was an amazing thing. I still love all the people that I've done that with. I've been to America. I went to the Texas World Convention. I went to the World Convention in Barcelona. Conventions all around England, campouts and everything. I'm not good at sleeping on sleeping bags, all that intense anymore. I like 5-star hotels. But yeah, in California, I went to the committee meeting of the convention, the North California convention, which I found out it was like a higher power thing, and I was there, and I found out that they make the most money. It helps to make enough money to carry them their fundraiser for a year, and they donate and stuff. And they, I found about how they do service is rotational service. I've had five really beautiful women sponsors, and I have a man sponsor at the moment who is amazing. I trust him. He knew me when I was first coming to NA. He said on the meeting the other night something about, I knew her when she was denying the fact that she needed to get completely clean and totally abstinent. And yeah, I mean, I do work with sponsees, and we work with NA literature, which is wonderful because it isn't my opinion. I'm not expressing my opinion. The literature's there for people to work their own recovery, And have found that it works. I'm just there, I listen, I guide, I do share as well, because this is all I have, is my own experience. Part of the miracles that have happened in recovery, apart from the traveling, my daughter lives in a beautiful country now. She's married, she has two beautiful children. My son's married, he's got a lovely little girl, they both own their own houses. I mean, it's just like I was talking before, and they when they're chatting away, when we all get together, they're talking about how much they pay in tax and tax consultants and this and that. And I think, what happened? They were crazy. They were crazier than me, the end of my using, I thought I was going to lose them. I did everything I could to keep them out of care systems, and social services were, like they were on a maximum risk. So I mean, when I look at my recovery and I think, how did I get from there to where I am now? I live now. I live back in London these days, and have a lovely house and a garden, and be careful what you wish for. You have to do the gardening and the housework. I'm happy, and I know what it says about, I've been very ill this year. I've had two really major illnesses, and thought I was going to die at one point. Had a lot of people praying for me, and I'm very grateful that I know a lot of people. I only ever knew three people, that we all sat in one room for God knows how long, and that kind of good close friends. I've also had some bad experiences trusting people, but generally, life has been really good. My son's been to university, I've been to university, I've qualified. It's not about the outside stuff, but that I found myself studying three really, really, profound interests for me, and was guided to that. And I mean, it's just incredible what you can do in recovery. I was told you can do anything, and it's true. If you want to work at it, if you want, and I don't mean like career work, I mean step work, I mean working with people, I mean working with your family, working with your friends, and a higher power, God of your understanding. And I wish you all well, and I hope that I haven't gone on too long. Thank you, Steve, for asking me, Jay, for your service, and everyone else who does service on these meetings. I love you all so much. You've really saved me in my convalescence from my illnesses, be able to come online. Thank you.